It's important to ask before you start human-centric design, what's the goal? Because it's not sufficient if you're going to be working with living systems. So I kept saying to you in the previous one, well, you can't use the first two and work with humans. You say, well, how about humans? And now I'm telling you, there is a human-centric paradigm design field, but it doesn't work when you take it to whole living systems.
Welcome to Business Second Opinion. This is the podcast that digs deep to answer questions about business and business practice you may not know you need to ask. We believe you should be asking for the benefit of your understanding and your business ethics and practice. In the process of answering these questions, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, but that is well tested and proven to give you the outcomes you really want without the nasty side effects. We make our thinking explicit so you can apply it to another topic, educating all around. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big, hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
What are we going to take a look at today?
I've been getting a lot of requests to talk about design thinking, and it's a concept that's been used in the creative world, you know, like product designs, things that were physical and we could see for a long time. But in the last decade, it's suddenly become what people are calling a social technology. And it's considered to be really important in everything from software that's behind the hardware we know about to systems for communication. And in fact, how people work together. My book, The Regenerative Business, which has been out about a year now, is about the design of work systems and how people can be organized to produce a work. It's in some circles, this idea of design thinking is the hottest thing going. And just about every consulting company on the face of the earth right now, whether it's the big three or four accounting groups down to some small technology group, they all offer design thinking. You put that into a search engine, you'll be buried for pages and pages. My question is it really new or is it just renaming something and redefining maybe what was an older practice? And in fact, is it even one thing? Is there such a thing as design thinking?
Yeah, that's actually what I'm curious about today. So I'm curious to learn a little bit more about how you would define design thinking, because from my review, it seems like they define it as a social technology that uses tools and insights to help people be more creative in their work and actually apply that creativity more fully. As I was reading through these articles that we're going to kind of go through in a minute, there are some common threads in how most people design it in publications. First is the idea of adding empathy for the user into early stages. So getting in the shoes of their user or customer, so to speak, ultimately the person who's going to benefit from the design. Second is the idea of prototyping many different options and testing them in the market and then iterating rapidly to get closer and closer to what the customer actually needs. And then third, often mentioned is the idea of seeking to simplify down to basics rather than the kitchen sink mode. This is picked up, I think, from watching Apple's success in the field of product design and packaging design, and sometimes, but not always, the I word, innovation, is said throughout. That all seems pretty boilerplate. So what's your challenge with all of it, Carol?
Well, as I read what people wrote, there are several questions that get raised in my mind about what we're calling design thinking in practice. We can't cover all of them today, but four of them that I thought we might could touch on a bit is, and of course you won't be surprised to hear me say that there are different paradigms behind the practice of design thinking. So there's no one thing. There are four different paradigms and people are using these words. And I think we need to unpack and differentiate that a bit because there's a lot of mixing and matching of the paradigms, you know, a little of this one, a little of that one. Secondly, the methods that are used in each of these paradigms, from each of these paradigms, are not even compatible. I mean, if you think about and are conscious of your goal, you would notice that we're trying to do something that's incompatible with the goal we're trying to achieve. And I thought we ought to lift that up a little bit and understand how they're working. Third, I think that they actually start from a different ground, which is one of the things I'd really like to maybe lay a bit of groundwork for. And that means they end up with class one errors. You know, class one errors when you start in the wrong place or you start incompletely. And these four different paradigms do start in different places. And then finally, at least for today, I would say, they all have a different idea about what pattern means, because I think that one of the underlying principles of design means that you're trying to get a better pattern that you could work with. And there's everything from replicating it to being able to create it. And so those are the questions that pop into my head.
Okay, so before we get started here, let me tell people what we're referencing so our listeners can check all this out and make sure they double check our work to make sure we're not pulling the wool over their eyes. They're all in the Harvard Business Review. One is from 2015, one's from 2017, and then this last one is from last month, September, October, 2018. September 2015 had a piece from John Kolko entitled Design Thinking Comes of Age. About 18 months later, in January of 2017, Roger L. Martin offered a piece entitled Use Design Thinking to Build Commitment to a New Idea. And then finally, Gene Liedtke focused on the innovation section under Why Design Thinking Works, particularly focusing on one of the criticisms of design thinking, although unfairly, I think, since some of the biases are actually left unresolved throughout the entire article that we're going to address today. Okay, Carol, so where do we start here?
Yeah, and I was just thinking in that last piece you mentioned, I think it's that those biases that she's speaking to are in all kinds of thinking. So I felt like the article was a little unfair to her. Yeah, so I mentioned up earlier that I thought there was a place people start that often gets them in trouble. And I want to, maybe I'll present this kind of an overarching idea that I don't think is differentiated and people can't see when they talk about design thinking. And I'm going to refer to this as two perspectives. One is an essence perspective and the other is an existence perspective. When I say the words, probably existence is just pretty quickly easy to be grasped. It's most of the thinking we do starts with what already exists. What can we pick up with our senses and try and improve on it or change it some? We're trying to, I think, as we look at existence, design out the problems that are there, get more back from the things that we see out there, and maybe make customers happy by or happier by better matching their, at least what we understand is their needs. But when we start with a problem, an issue, we're starting with existence. It's what's manifest now, not in the future. And the downfall of starting with this perspective is that it draws on the only options that are already available in existence. That is, we draw on existence to understand and to change it. And I think there's a lot of talk in the design literature about an objective view of reality. So you spend a lot of time trying to get an objective view, one we can all agree on. And we can see the same thing. We agree we're seeing the same thing when we look at it. We tend to be looking at things like the voids, and do we all see that void? But let's contrast that to essence, which is a strange word. And of course, it's really core to the paradigm that we work with. Essence is not ever replicated in any two entities, and it has no preceding sources. So you can't go back in time and find out where it came from because it's unique and specific to a living entity. So let's take, for example, one that we all were at one time. Each child, at least at a non-physical level, is unique, a one of one. It's not derived from something else. Now, they do have a personality that is acquired through condition and accommodating to the context that they live in. We all do that as we grow up. But there is this aspect at the level of our nature that is what Aristotle called essence. He may have been the one, at least in the Western world, that formed that term. The Greek term, I will never be able to say, but it literally meant what it was to be. Now, that's a strange way of saying it. So it's like this entity came into existence, and what it came in was to be what it was to be. In other words, Aristotle was trying to say, I think, that it can only be understood in regard or respect to itself. You can't compare it. You can't contrast it. That it comes from itself. It has no predecessor, no prototype, no antecedent. It belongs to a thing in respect of itself, and therefore it belongs to its essence. Every entity in a living system has this way of being. It has an essence which does not exist in the real world, but can be manifest and expressed into the existent world.
It sounds to me like essence is where potential resides, like a ball held in the hand from an edge of a building or a roof ready to be dropped. It's all potential energy, in a sense. It can be thrown in many directions, up, sideways, towards the roof next door, and released to fall on its own trajectory. But once it falls to the ground, all options are exhausted. It's now realized. Is that kind of what you mean?
Well, that's what I learned in physics, right? That potential energy was. And I do believe that's a pretty good metaphor, because once it is in existence, it can't really be changed. It can be modified. Most design thinking seems to be done after the ball, if we stay with your metaphors, hit the ground. And the alternative options are closed, the ones we had before we dropped the ball. The only ones that are left about what to do with the ball are on the ground now. And a group comes together and considers what they see. Is the ball on its side? Did it have an impact on the fall? And there are many efforts to try and come to an objective reality. A lot of what we end up doing when we're doing this kind of design thinking is consensus forming, because it's done because we're told you must start with a problem definition or an issue articulation and the failure or shortfalls that came from that. So starting from essence requires looking at the essence of an entity, a child, an employee, a market. Like, what's the essence of this particular customer? And conceiving of what is not yet manifest, but as Aristotle told us, it's in the forming of its nature and what it is to be. So it's not existence that needs to be changed or improved, but we need to look at how to manifest essence. And even as I talk about this, I know it's really hard to conceptualize it. So we'll do a couple of examples here.
Let me back you up for a second. So why does this matter? It seems to me that starting with what you can see is actually easier.
Yeah, I know.
This is where we're going to go here. But as I was taught in every decision-making process and in parenting and research classes I've taken, you have to start with a problem definition. We always have to start with a problem. I definitely feel that at times using this problem solution kind of formula has helped me to clarify so much. Do I chalk that up to it being a familiar process for me? I know that one of the major biases in our brain seeks is kind of using what we already know. It definitely feels comfortable as a familiar pattern. So how else do you see that we could start, Carol?
It is a challenge because our entire culture, scientific culture, parenting culture, education culture, all is problem defined now. You can't even get money, can't make proposals without starting there. I think maybe one of the best ways to help with this, and it takes just a moment to tell you, but there's a story. And I tell this story in a much more extensive way in my new book, The Regenerative Business, about a mom named Nancy and her daughter named Jane that I worked with some years ago. But I think the story will ring true for all of us. Nancy came to me because she was having challenges with her 12-year-old daughter, Jane, and she was worried that Jane was misbehaving and was being reminded of her own troubled childhood. I asked her to tell me about the problems she was encountering and what she was doing to address them. So she reported, you know, Jane talks back, she refuses to do what she's asked, she's impolite. And of course, this was driving Nancy crazy. And so she told me what she'd done is she had critiqued and tried to point out to Jane what she was doing, instituted punishments like, you know, you won't be able to go out with your friends if you don't complete your homework. In other words, she really did see the problems in her daughter's behavior, and she was in full problem-solving mode. So that's where the question you asked came from. But I wanted to shift her away from being a problem-focused parent with a problem child. So I asked her if there were things she had discovered that were working, which moves her up a slight paradigm. And she reported that when she could find activities to share with her daughter, the relationship was stronger, and her daughter seemed to be a little more solid for some periods. Like, they both like mysteries. And so Nancy would bring home mysteries from the library and they'd read them and they'd talk about them together, laugh. They also enjoyed baking and inventing new cookies. So that when they shared activities, they engaged in a more positive relationship. My question, I think, moved Nancy to think about what it meant to come from the do-good paradigm of parenting. I was able to next introduce a line of questioning that evoked potential for mother and daughter. I began with the question, what does Jane really get excited and fully engaged in when she's doing it? This took a moment. Nancy had to think about it. She said, well, when she's being theatrical, she writes little plays, puts them on with her friends. She stages them, invites people to come watch. I get to watch them. It's as though she's working through the big questions in her own life through theater. The effect of this shift on Jane's deepest interest into the experience of Jane's deepest interest was almost immediately. And so, you know, I said to Nancy, well, what do you see is really at the heart of what she's doing? And she said, well, I don't know. It's like the seed of being a storyteller. And I asked if there was any particular kind of story, she said, and you could see her imaging in her mind, Jane at work in this creative process. And she said, well, yeah, she writes stories about her own life. I can see that she's understanding how life unfolds as she works on them. It even has an effect on her friends, she reported. So I reflected back to her, well, it looks like we know something about Jane's what essence or authentic self. So let's reflect just a moment on what I've just offered. What's the difference between how you're working on being a mother to Jane, and of course, the way we were each parented too, and what you're seeing now? She said, well, you know, I need to remember what brings her alive, what it is that's really unique to her. I need to start with what's important with her. In fact, it is the being of herself. And out of this conversation, an amazing thing happened. Nancy was starting to be able to join with her daughter in support of this deep development process. She went out and bought Jane stage makeup, found a small movie camera, recorded her productions. She really supported her in breaking through into this role that she wanted to be in rather than try and role model these adherent standards she wanted to live to. Probably 10 years later that I went to a children's theater production in the town where they lived. The children had written and produced their own short plays. Sound familiar? Something struck me as so familiar about this, and I checked my program for the name of the program director, and sure enough, it was Jane. She was now a young adult.
So I'd like to take a minute and thank our sponsors who are working to examine their own worldviews and their own paradigms and how it affects their way of working with management and even strategy. And they have one of my favorite deep business ideas, using ancient wisdom coupled with modern innovation to give vitalizing beverages you can be proud of. Their rallying cry is, "We are a rebel, a band of revolutionaries for the greater good." They are modern day botanical treasure hunters grounded in ancient herbal wisdom, identifying and gathering the very best the plant queendom has to offer. Check out Carol's podcast on the regenerative business with their CEO, Cheryl O'Loughlin. You can find that on the podcast app you're using right now in front of you, or check out episode 118 Business Second Opinion show notes for the link to the podcast. So it sounds like essence is the true source of innovation and a way to evolve some new aspect of existence. So we're not actually starting with ideas framed from existence we can agree on or redefine and use. This is a really different perspective, and I'm trying to get my head around it, but I'm always curious about using paradigms, which we've talked about a lot, as a means to understand different ways of seeing the world. I notice myself doing that more and more as I read writings in business and personal practice, and I ask myself, what paradigm are they using here to write from? I also began to see this in these articles. Is that where you're headed here, Carol?
You bet. What I noticed is that most of the examples that are there come from what let's call the value return paradigm. So we're designing to get a return. We're looking at how to design to produce a better return on a process we use, a product we sell, a system we depend on. The pattern we're working with here is to design something that's better adherence to standards that we've set need to achieve. So that's one paradigm that people actually use to think about design. And sometimes it goes all the way down to rules that need to be followed. They usually are designed in a way that they accommodate to the people and the materials to help them get closer to the pattern they think is desired to get the return either the customer wants or in some cases the employer wants. So it's often the basis of design thinking when you're looking for a portfolio of options as people will go to this value return. Let me describe just a little what that looks like so you know why it goes where it does. They go into brainstorming processes that are geared. And the minute you start with brainstorming, you start with existence because you're asking, what do people think? What have they experienced? And by definition, you pull everyone into this lowest paradigm once you start with existence. And now you're in the value return design thinking. By the way, that's what Nancy was doing when she was seeking to get Jane to adhere to her standards.
So this is also the place I actually start thinking from when I'm asked to start with a problem. Something's clicking for me here, I think, Carol. I get the problem defined, agreed to, and find options to overcome it. I see this all the time with software, for example. It breaks and we need to fix it. This returns us not to a new potential place, but actually adhering back to whatever the previous pattern was. This is really about making something work, almost maybe even back to this idea of satisficing that we talked about a long time ago, which is really about narrowing focus rather than continuing to hold a larger view. And even more so, As this newest article states, the second step is to look at the cause or causes behind the problem. This perspective actually pulls us even further into existence thinking and therefore into this value return paradigm that you're talking about. In the Why Design Thinking Works article, it's used to structure things so tightly, that is, design thinking manages and accommodates for the biases and counterproductive tendencies of people. The pattern this mindset invites is pattern adherence and designing processes so people can't go wrong. You might even think of the analogy of something akin to Google search engine suggestion algorithms. It's meant to help, but it really just takes all the hard thinking out of the process and narrows our thinking over time, which is actually a pretty scary idea if you think about it.
Yeah, what you're really pointing out, Zach, is that the bottom two paradigms in most of these articles here, the bottom two being the value return paradigm and the limitations it has that you just exposed, but it's also pointing to the problem-solving paradigm, which we sometimes call a rest disorder. And what the problem-solving paradigm does is it seeks to design out the source of problems, and it also seeks to decomplexify and to make it simpler for users, employees, and children. Now, before people start to say, but isn't that what we're working on here? I'm a little confused. Well, there certainly can be a reason to design this way. It's certainly important when we're thinking about reducing energy use, reducing waste or carbon footprint, sustainable practices, but it doesn't work so well when you design it for humans, use it for designing process for humans, as you could see in how Nancy was starting with the existence problem and then being stuck with where she went from there. One way of saying it is the most basic paradigm, the value return, is really working on pattern adherence, where the problem solving is working on pattern following, trying to get people to follow a certain pattern. And they'll design it and be able to replicate it so that you can get people moving forward on this pattern with some variation. They don't have to adhere to every detail. This kind of design thinking always originates with existence, and it tries to slow down the decline of living systems. It's useful, but as I said, not so great for when we think about humans.
I'm actually thinking back to last week now, and I'm a little curious, our last podcast, that is. So we were talking about the human potential paradigm at that point, I think. Does that show up in design thinking as well?
Yeah. So you're right. The next level up, and what you'll hear it called when it's in design thinking, is human-centric design. There's a whole field around it. IDEO, I think, probably is the one who brought it about. And there's a whole set of design firms which use ethnography because they know they've got to really study these patterns people have. And what they're working on then is being able to pattern differentiate. So we've gone from pattern adherence to pattern following, and now we're up to pattern differentiation. And what are the different types of people, different circumstances, where the bottom two would tend to design generically and aggregate them for all people? This level, the human-centric design, tries to be very specific, somewhat to generic all humans, but also they spend time thinking about this human, different humans, you know, humans who are in various ethnographic groups. They do this a lot for process and system design, where product designers are using it to get beyond the lower two paradigms. It's important to ask before you start human-centric design, what's the goal? Because it's not sufficient if you're going to be working with living systems. So I kept saying to you in the previous one, well, you can't use the first two and work with humans. You said, well, how about humans? And now I'm telling you, there is a human-centric paradigm design field, but it doesn't work when you take it to whole living systems.
Let me also first point out where human-centric design is often used. You might see this in the management world with customer interface processes. These always seem obvious. Market research and customer service, for example. The latest article seems to be applying it to the employee buy-in process by getting them involved early on in an idea or for option or opinion generation. Empathy, it seems, is also included in a big way here. Although thinking of users in this way comes from doing customer journey maps, which is probably something you're also familiar with. This is where they try to look at the steps of a process in the customer experience and design based on a desired experience they want to create for that customer. This whole idea is really about getting in the shoes of the customer. Does that sound about right, Carol?
Well, it does. But what you've just described actually now takes us back to the lower two paradigms, because doing a customer journey map looks at the physical movement and the experiential movement of people in existence. What have they been like? What do we want them to be like? So we're starting in a place that we are in the customer's shoes, but we're in their use experience. In theory, you know, what you just offered is true, but the design examples we're given here, again, all go back to the experience of the user. And it's very centric on humans. It gives a set of universal categories, demographics, and again, we're dropping out two things. We're dropping out a living systems paradigm where in which humans exist. It also is dropping out any unique customer, unique system or child, and works more with trying to get more universal categories. And the human-centric design movement and human potential movement generally do a lot of trying to put together types of people, types of practices. In the living systems world, there are no universal categories that can serve as a model for design. What you're really working on here is not trying to come up with ideal patterns, which you do for humans, but in living systems, you have to actually use completely different instruments and methods than the human-centric movement uses.
Okay, so let me see if I can start layering in the living systems view and its methods here. It's always the most complete, I find, and the most thorough, more what we need to help us with all these dynamics and challenges in the world. But living systems, as we've discussed, is also a view that requires building a new capability because we're not just educated to do this level of thinking and not called on it in school, for example, or in most jobs. Certainly as citizens, we're not called often to be able to use this. How do we start to think about this more concretely here, Carol?
Well, let me just comment on what you just said, it being so true. One of the reasons we don't step into this living system paradigm and we fall back into these lower three paradigms are things we can see that are in existence. But the biggest thing you just pointed out is it's a mind shift. It's literally not a paradigm shift, but you have to use a different mind. So in living systems design thinking, you move beyond this pattern adherence, pattern following, and now move beyond pattern differentiation, the pursuing of ideals of their experience, to what I would call pattern generating. But it's pattern generating for each unique entity. So if we go back to my opening, when I said the overarching idea I think we have to come to grips with is it always starts from essence. It starts from the essence of a child, the essence of a watershed, the essence of a user or a particular business that's going to be using it. It actually goes beyond standing in the shoes because when people use that, just think about what their mind is doing. They're actually saying, I'm standing in the shoes, but what they're doing is looking at the customer or the person using their product to accomplish a goal that they're after. So they're not even getting out into the life of this person, and they rarely are trying to see them as a one-of-one being. There are no examples in any of the articles on design thinking that I could find that really represent going here, because we're looking at, as you said, complex dynamic systems, often on a grand scale, and you can't use focus groups, you can't use questionnaires or interviews, because all those then become customer-centric, and they tend to take you back to existence. One of the things that I would tell people they'll be able to notice if they've really moved to doing a living systems paradigm is they're using living systems frameworks. Frameworks we've talked about on this podcast a couple of times, but it means literally getting away from models, which are about what you replicate, to thinking frameworks, which are designed to help us understand these large complex systems. And of course, we teach that, I write about it, you work with it in your work and your businesses. And it means that we're choosing a way to think. We ask the question before we start, how do we want to think about this? How complexly? And we choose from a one term, two term, three term, four term. We ask how complicated or complex really is a better word. We also make sure that we're working with a really specific real entity, real people, real watershed. This one, it has a name. And otherwise, our answers to what we're trying to do when we get to one-on-one become very abstract. They're not grounded. And they can't be used for developing and generating a new pattern. If you're going to go to the universals, these generic ideas, then in a living systems paradigm of design thinking, you start with first principles, not existence. Everybody is always commenting on the importance of starting with first principles because Elon Musk uses it. But people misinterpret quite a bit and they pull it back down to a problem-solving paradigm. First principles, if you think about the laws of physics, and of course they evolve and they move when you go from one era to another, but they always provide a master framework of that helps us understand what we currently know about these complex systems. And it gives our mind, or let's even say a group of minds, people who are coming together with a shared framework, they will be able to watch something unfolding in real time. So imaging is another part of this. You're learning to see what David Bohm called the implicate order. It's like it's implied. It's not yet in existence. If you look behind Jane, what she was doing with theater and stuff implied something she was trying to do. And the way I worked with Nancy was to help her see the implicate order that could help her see this essence, this authentic storytelling child who was seeking to tell the story, drawing from real life, and eventually brought that into other children's lives and created amazing changes for them. So you're not yet in existence. In fact, it's not a trend. So some of you are saying, oh, you mean trends. Nope, because trends are already in existence and more people are moving toward it. Nancy no longer looked at what she was seeing right in front of her, but what was implied by what made Jane most alive, the heart of what made her alive. So Jane is a living system, not something you should work on with a value return paradigm or a problem solving paradigm. And in fact, you had to actually put her in the context of the world she lived in beyond just humans, if we had time to add all that story. It's hidden behind what most people do with systems design thinking because it's fragmented and it's really not systems, it's design thinking. So there's a lot more to cover on it, but maybe that gives us a taste of it for today.
Well, I definitely want to thank you for today's conversation, Carol. This has definitely been a shift of mind for me. I want to take a moment to also thank our other sponsor of today's show, Numi Tea. Numi is one of the courageous ones that continues to question and examine themselves and their ways of working.
Numi, we also probably should say, is, and Rebel as well, have been a part of the Regenerative Business Development Series, where we're all learning about this way of thinking and how we use living systems processes. We've gotten close to them and become so amazed at who they are as people, the cultures they create. I'm doubly honored that they agreed to sponsor our show and our show notes.
So this is the kind of work we work on in our Business and Change Agent series. And we invite people to join us in the membership of these communities if you're curious. If you are curious, feel free to reach out to Carol at carolsanford.com. Or you could also leave us a message through SurveyMonkey or our Google Voice line, which is 650-265-1193. That is 6502-HUMAN. You could also feel free to leave us a question or speaking to an upcoming podcast or topic that you'd like to hear. Also, for more, you can download the show notes at businesssecondopinion.com. And for more on worldviews, Carol recently did a talk at the University of Washington, and you could find that link in the show notes for episode 119. This has been Business Second Opinion.